Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum, a venue for spoken word presentations in many forms. We feature writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In today's episode, how many of us get to live out a childhood dream? When he was 6 years old, John Hargrove's parents took him to SeaWorld. He came away with the dream of someday swimming and working with killer whales. And that dream came true. Hargrove was a killer whale trainer for 14 years, mainly at SeaWorld. But John Hargrove found the dream he'd hoped for was based on a dark illusion. He and others argue that the captivity of killer whales is unsafe and unhealthy for whales and trainers alike. They say that for the whales, the stress of life in cramped pools and separation from social groups leads to disease, mental and physical harm, and curtailed lifespans. Shortly after quitting SeaWorld, Hargrove gained attention for his part in the documentary Blackfish. The film chronicles conditions at SeaWorld theme parks and the death of Don Branchot, a SeaWorld trainer killed by an orca in 2010. Since the release of Blackfish, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration has banned SeaWorld from permitting its personnel to enter tanks to train and perform with orcas. Attendance and earnings are down at the company's 11 theme parks. In response, SeaWorld launched a campaign to address negative public perceptions. In it, they contend killer whales in captivity are thriving and enjoy a similar lifespan to that of whales in the wild. John Hargrove's new memoir is Beneath the Surface, Killer Whales, SeaWorld, and the Truth Beyond Blackfish. He spoke at Town Hall Seattle on March 30, 2015. Town Hall and University Bookstore sponsored the event as part of the Seattle Science Lectures. Thanks to Jenny Cecil Moore for this recording.
Now, to introduce tonight's guest, please welcome University of Washington public health student Kelsey Puller.
John Hargrove spent 14 years as a killer whale trainer, working at SeaWorld California, SeaWorld Texas, and Marineland in the south of France, and was promoted all the way to the rank of senior trainer. In 2012, though, he resigned from his position at SeaWorld and has since spent his time shedding a light on the treatment of orcas in captivity and has become an advocate for them both in the 2013 documentary Blackfish and in his new book, Beneath the Surface, Killer Whales, SeaWorld, and the Truth Beyond Blackfish. Tonight, he joins us to discuss the complex emotional lives and intelligence of the killer whale and give us all a sense of what we might do to improve their lives. So please offer up a warm welcome for John Hargrove.
Thank you. Thank you guys for having me here tonight. It feels wonderful. You know, I was worried. I was curious if I would feel anxious or have anxiety about coming on these tours, but I've actually felt very relaxed and calm going into them, and I don't quite know why, but it feels great. Before I start, though, I do want to point out that there are some very special people in the audience here tonight, to me personally and professionally. So both Jeff Ventry and Carol Ray, who also starred in Blackfish and are huge advocates, are here. And and the amount of awareness that these guys have put out there is just amazing, and they've been role models to me. I've learned a thing or two from them in the last 2.5 years. And also, Howard Garrett is also in the crowd. And So after I get through what I would like to say to you tonight and get through the Q&A, I'm going to invite those guys up on stage because I think you really want to see them and hear what they have to say just in general. So let's get started. So, you know, how did I go from, you know, being this little boy that had this dream and wanted this life with killer whales and achieving that dream and being happy at SeaWorld for so many years and being a SeaWorld loyalist and believing everything that they said and defended them to now standing here tonight and being in front of you. And a lot of things happened, and it was a gradual process. And you know, when I look back on it now, it's kind of scary to see how it all unfolded, because it's a very cult-like mentality. And Carol said to me once, and it's actually in the book, because one night we were having one of our famous behavioral discussions, like killer whale trainers like to do, and we were having a disagreement, which is totally normal, and we have different views on things at times and approaches with the whales. And she said to me, she said, you know, sometimes when you're away from it longer, you get a greater perspective. And it just really stopped me in my tracks, because it really resonated with me. And the last 2.5 years, I've thought about that countless times, because it has proven to be so true, so incredibly true. So for me, I'll just briefly, don't worry, I won't give you like the once upon a time, I was six, and go through all that, don't worry. But once upon a time, I was six, no. But my parents took me to SeaWorld of Florida in 1980, and here I'm this child, and I am in Shamu Stadium, and it's 5,000 people, and the lights are going, and the music is going, and I was already, of course, an animal lover, because that's either in you or it's not. And to see these animals that I'd never seen before, these incredible killer whales, that despite what living conditions they're in, and this is where I think it confuses so many people, it's the animal that is so magnificent. It's the animal that is so impressive. So when you walk away and you go, wow, that was amazing, it's not because they were in that concrete little tank that they shouldn't have been in. It's because they are impressive. And so it really psychologically does that number on you. But especially as a child, I was just so seduced by that atmosphere, seeing this little bitty trainer and this magnificent animal I had never seen before, having this relationship and all of the technical end of it and all of the people. And from that day forward, it formed my identity. And you know, growing up in the 70s and 80s, I didn't think about captivity in Southeast Texas, too. That may have played a role, I don't know. But the 70s, let's just say it's for safety reasons, 70s and 80s. You know, I didn't think of anything about it. I just thought it was normal. And even when I started my career at SeaWorld of Texas in 1993 at age 20, I still thought it was fine. I didn't think anything about it. And even seeing the collapsed dorsal fins, even seeing the teeth that were so badly damaged, at that stage in your career, you don't know anything. It takes you years before you learn about killer whales, and certainly before you're interacting with killer whales, swimming with killer whales, all that. So I didn't know. I thought, well, I guess the dorsals are like that in the wild. And of course, SeaWorld's teaching us that too. You know, the line that we were taught to say to the public was 23% of all photographed killer whales in the wild have a collapsed dorsal. Well, we all know that that's untrue. You hear Jeff say that in Blackfish, less than 1%. And Dr. Ingrid Visser has even repeatedly sent letters, official letters to SeaWorld, to tell them to stop misquoting her research. They still continue to use her research and distort it. So to try to make people think that this is something that's normal when we know that it's not. So, and that's SeaWorld's game, as we know. They're master manipulators, and they'll give a half-truth. Sometimes it's not a truth at all, but that half-truth, they can glamorize it. They had the power and money for so many years to make the perfect commercials and seduce people right in, and look how happy these whales are, and look at how much we love them, and how much of a family we all are, and it's all a facade. It's all a facade. And when I began my career, before I even noticed, because, you know, I was such a low-level ranked trainer in the beginning, and it was before I was doing everything with the animals and certainly with the killer whales, the first sign that not all was right in Oz was how they treated the trainers. Here, I thought I was coming into this environment, you know, as a boy growing up, that we were all going to live happily ever after and all love each other and support each other and live these magical lives with these whales. And you get into it, and it's immediately a cutthroat environment. it's immediately a fear-induced environment of you better do what we tell you to do or we're going to take this all away from you. Everything that you've wanted, your whole childhood, your whole dream is going to be gone just like that if you challenge us. So, you know, you shut up. It shuts you up because you don't want to lose your childhood dream. You want to be with those animals. So, you know, there were some trainers, and their stories are in this book, and I won't get into it, but you'll read it. But there were some distinct role models of mine that were star trainers. So as I was a lower level ranked trainer, and they were the ranked trainer that I wanted to become one day, I thought these people were untouchable because they were true stars at Shamu Stadium and just fantastic with the whales and fantastic in the water and behaviorally and just showmen. And I thought these guys were untouchable until they challenged management on something or spoke up and said, I don't agree with that. That's not right. This is not right for this animal. And then I saw how quickly they fell from grace and they were defamed. They were ridiculed. They were blacklisted. So many trainers that nearly died from fatalities, from injuries from whales that sued SeaWorld for negligence. SeaWorld ended up forcing them into settlements and gag orders because that's what they wanted. You know, more than the settlement was the gag order, that you can never speak about these incidents. And even a great example of that is in the movie, Blackfish, that scene where Tamari Tollison, she gets pulled in by Orchid, but you see two whales dragging her under Orchid and Splash, and Splash is actually the whale that actually crunched her arm. And yes, Tamari made mistakes, but the point of that story is that that video, however SeaWorld, and I don't know, we had our own rumors with all of us, but you know, obviously they were very persuasive with the public who shot that video because they got the only copy of it from the patrons that visited the park. So they got that copy of that video, and it was under lock and key at Shamu Stadium, and only us at Shamu Stadium, trainers, ever saw that video until Don was killed. It was confiscated as evidence, and it was submitted as evidence as trial, and then under the Freedom of Information Act, it was released. This is just one example of a million that I could give you of how not transparent this company is. This is how much they have to hide that, you know, that these things are not revealed to the public. And of course, we have to abide by that. We can't speak about those incidents to the public, you know, or you lose your job, you don't get your promotion, they move you away from the animals that you're working with, whether it's killer whales that you have the relationships with and you love, maybe you're at Sea Lion, you're happy there and you love those animals, they take you away from there. There's always this way to get you, and it's very obvious, and we all know it, and they all knew it. So they had us because it was our passion, it was our dream. We loved those animals. We were there for the right reasons. But as time went on, it was just undeniable the horrific effects of captivity on these animals. Once you realize, wait, that's not normal that their dorsal fins are collapsed. It's not normal that their teeth are so badly ground down and broken off from out of boredom biting the stage and biting ledges of the pool that they would develop pinholes into their teeth and then they would get abscesses and we would have to go in and manually drill the tooth in what is known as a pulpotomy. And once it would erupt, then we would have to every day from the rest of their life invasively irrigate their teeth with a metal catheter in and out of the hole repeatedly with a hydrogen peroxide solution. This is their world-class veterinary care, which I'd like to poke a hole in right now since we're on this. Forgive me if I go off on these tangents, but I have time, so I feel like kill it while we can. When they get on and they say, we have world-class veterinary care, you do. But that world-class veterinary care is to treat what's happened to these animals because of captivity. That's what you're treating. It's not because they need this world-class veterinary care out in the wild. It's because these animals are suffering from chronic stress that causes ulcers. They have to be on medications every single day. Jeff and Carol and I were talking about that the other day, and Sam Berg, who's not here tonight, but tagament. We use tagament on most of the whales every single day. Splash, Una, they were on medications that I can remember every single day. They were on medications for their entire life. Una had, we didn't know how to identify it. She had these fungal spores in her urine, which represented a urinary, tract and not urinary tract, but infection. There was an infection in there that we could not identify. So she was on this medication to treat that for her entire life, every single day. And we didn't know what caused it. We didn't know where it was coming from. We just knew that we couldn't get rid of it. Jeff Fintry pointed out, they put in a paper, it's in the book, how two of our whales in our collection have died from mosquito-transmitted encephalitis. This is something that does not happen naturally to whales in the wild. So what SeaWorld wants you to believe is that they live in these pristine environments, and that's the reason why they could never go to a sea sanctuary. They could never be reintroduced back into the wild because the wild is dangerous. The wild causes is where all the pollution is, and the wild is the reason why they're endangered. The southern resident population is endangered is because they decimated the population right here in your waters in the 60s and 70s and nearly wiped out that population. And now they have the audacity to try to say that that's why they need to keep having them in captivity so that they can save them. That's disgusting. I mean, it's like fingernails on a chalkboard when I hear them say that. And also their idea of that, their message, and they make it very clear, you don't have to even read between the lines, their message is that we haven't learned everything yet we need to learn from these animals, so we must keep them in captivity. First of all, who gave you the right to decide that you, because you want to know something about an animal, that you have the right to take them from their natural environment, strip them from their families, killing their family members in the process, and keep them caged because you want to learn something? That's just the height of arrogance and stain upon humanity. And they say it to this day. When Carol was just testifying in Washington for that bill, which will definitely pass, you know, they said that. That's what they said. They said almost, I'm paraphrasing it maybe just a little, but it was almost word for word. It's just, it's unbelievable. And, you know, especially because this is not the 1970s or 80s anymore. This is 2015. People do not think like this anymore. You know, when, like I said, growing up, no, I didn't think about that. But now people are so much more progressive, especially here. And they've seen what these types of parks do to these animals, and they are not suited for captivity. They're not thriving. They're not surviving. And, you know, we started in our blackfish promotion, we were using the word, you know, that they are not thriving. Then SeaWorld tried to take that away from us. Now they try to use it in their PR junk. I'll say it like that because that's really what it is. Like, oh, our animals are thriving. Well, not really. When you look at the death rates and you look at the ages that those animals have died and what they're dying from, I certainly would not say that your animals are thriving. All the medical, the host of medical conditions that we have to treat those whales with, some that are on medications every single day of their life. The other one I love is our successful breeding program. Let's analyze that for a second. So Taku bred his mother, so direct inbreeding that produced a calf, Nalani. That doesn't happen in the wild. So Keto inbred Kohana. Keto is her uncle, so that's also considered direct inbreeding. He inbred her twice, and that's, again, would not have happened in the wild. And let's look at also why maybe that was even allowed to happen in that social structure. So they took Ohana at only 3 years old away from her mother, Takara, sent her to Spain. She was the oldest female at age 3. So she had no mother anymore at age 3, and not even another adult female her own age or even older to help her out. And then her uncle, Keto, inbreeds her twice. I'm going to push this over, I know it. She rejects both of her calves, no surprise, because she doesn't know. What happens with people when that happens? When someone has, like when a child, an 11-year-old, a 12-year-old has a child and you see that the baby's been discarded in the wastebasket in the bathroom in school. Why would we think that this calf would have the knowledge to know what to do? So she rejected both calves, and the second calf died within its first year of life. This is not a successful breeding program. This is an abomination. That's what that is. There's no other way. How can they even with a straight face call a breeding program that has inbreeding, now crossbreeding between different whales that wouldn't even interact in the wild, that has created hybrid whales with no true social identity, so basically a genetic mutant that doesn't even exist in the wild, and that you have calves that are rejecting their own calves and they're dying. How is this exactly a successful breeding program? I don't really get it. But they'll continue to say it in their speeches. And any time that they're cornered with anything, they go straight to their talking points. They're carefully crafted, carefully worded talking points. If you say something about Kohana, they'll go, well, we save manatees and sea turtles. That's fantastic. I'm so happy that you save manatees and sea turtles. I actually think that's great. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about killer whales in captivity, and should they be in captivity? And we all know in this room the answer is no. There is an overwhelming amount of science now that makes it beyond a reasonable doubt. We know that these animals are dying, and they are suffering before they are dying, all in the name of entertainment and all in the name of profit. So I'll give you... This is my publisher wanted me to do this. So give you like a good story, like a good feel good story, and one of the highlights of the book, and then give you a bad one, a dark one. And I've been giving you some of the realities of SeaWorld, but of course. Probably know what I'm going to talk about when I'm going to talk about Don's death as the dark one of the darkest days. But I'm going to start with the feel-good one. So I didn't start off feeling good because I had broken my ribs on Takara in a show. It wasn't her fault. It wasn't aggression. My foot slipped off of her rostrum on a stand-on spy hop. And she was going, we had already pulled up along the bottom of the pool. We're about to break the surface. So she's going full speed so she can get her full length of her body above the surface of the water with me standing on her. And I felt my foot slipping off, and I was like, oh, I'm gonna try to hang on. I was just by my toe tips, but I just couldn't. And my foot washed off of her. You can tell in the video she's trying to stop, but she can't because we're breaking the surface. So she's 5,000 pounds. She's got the hardest rostrum of any whale that I've ever worked with. It's like a rock, so it was like bad luck. And it just hit me right in the ribs, and it broke ribs and soft tissue in the front and the back. So it just like compressed my rib cage. So as it knocked the breath out of me and, you know, sent me like a rag doll, of course, Takara is what we call sharking around you. So she's at the surface of the water, and she's going completely around me in a circle, and her dorsal fin is perfectly above the surface. Well, the entire time she's doing that, she's echolocating on me, and she's also vocalizing vocalizations that are consistent when an animal is concerned, like showing a type of concern about their environment, their social structure. Of course, as trainers, we learn to recognize all various types of vocalizations and what they mean. We don't know exactly what they're saying, but we know what moods and everything that they represent. So as she's doing this, you know, for those of you who don't know, their echolocation, they can, it's like basically a sonogram, having an ultrasound. They can see inside you. They can, if a woman, a trainer is pregnant, they can hear the second heartbeat. They can echolocate and see the fetus. I mean, it's very science fiction type stuff. So she can see inside me and see if something's broken or not. So she was continuing to go around me, echolocating. You can hear it. You can feel it in your chest. it's such a bizarre sensation, because even if they're far away, it feels like they're right here. It's just very odd. So ultimately, she came over to me, still making the concerned vocalizations. I put both of my hands on her rostrum. And Takara normally is a very rough ride. She's a very explosive animal. And it's one of the things I loved about her, because she was just dynamite. She was like, look, this is the way it's going to be. We're going to go fast, and you're either going to make it or you're not. But I'm not making any changes for you. And I love that about her, because that was her personality. And she would get into it. Like, she would challenge you. Like, okay, yeah, you think you're ready? Let's go a little faster. How about this? I mean, there was one crash scene that I have that I saved on blooper footage, and because she was racing another whale, and it's like, hey, you're forgetting you have a trainer on you, and you're racing this other whale. So she threw me, to beat Una at stage, she threw me so fast that I slid further than we had ever slid before, so it forced me to have to jump up to a second level, which no one had ever done before, and of course I just bit it and crashed and slid into the set. It was actually great. You know, those types of crashes are fun when you don't get hurt, but anyway, so back to her personality. So she's rough. She's a rough ride, and there were only a few of us that swam with her, or four of us that swam with her, because she was considered restricted. And but here, knowing, I mean, obviously we know the intelligence of this, well, we have a glimmer into how intelligent these animals are. You know, we've yet to learn everything. We have no idea what they're truly capable of. Could one day just absolutely amaze us even more than it does today. And she came to me very gently, didn't even cause, like, as her body shifted in front of me, no wake or anything like that that would make my body move or anything. I put both my hands on her rostrum. She stopped making the concerned vocalizations, and I asked her for a pec push. So, you know, it's like I put both of my feet out, and then she puts both of each one of her pecs on my feet, and then I can steer her which way I want to go. And normally, she'll hit you hard. Those pecs will hit your feet hard. One time she even knocked my back out of alignment because she hit my feet so hard. But in this situation, I never even felt her pecs touch my feet. Not at all. And I was at that point, everything was really starting to tighten up. I was starting to get in worse and worse shape. And I knew I couldn't make it out of the pool without her. I needed her to take me out of the pool. But I never felt her pecs touch my feet. So I'm effortlessly, you know, gliding into the back pool. She takes me to the back pool. Again, when we do a pec step off, which of course Jeff and Carol are very familiar with, you know, the whales tend to just like, kind of like toss you, throw you out of the pool, and it's everything on your body is just very jarring. There's nothing gentle about swimming with those size animals. And but in this situation, she sank down really deep. At this point, because you have to turn around to get off, now you're just one foot is on one pec, and the other one is just off to the side. She sank down really deep, and then she came up really slow and really high past her pectoral flippers. So all I had to do was take just the smallest step like that to step out of the pool instead of being thrown out of the pool. Now, what's amazing about that is that this is something that was not taught to her. We didn't teach her this. This was not part of her criteria. This is not what she knew, what she needed to do to be reinforced. This was a choice that she made based on the situation, which shows the intelligence of the whale. It shows the relationship, and it shows the awareness. So that's the good story. Now, unfortunately, I got to get to the bad one. So I tried to mark this because there's a couple of points, so hopefully I won't repeat myself. But all right, so when you know, Alexis had been killed on Christmas Eve, just 2 months before dawn, and we were back in the water with the whales, swimming in shows, including myself, within 2 days. We didn't have any details yet of what had happened to Alexis. It would take about 2.5-3 weeks to find out before we got the full account analysis and video. And even then, I directly asked Mike Scarpuzzi, when he gave the account analysis. Mike Scarpuzzi is the VP of Zoological in California. I asked him if keto had crushed Alexis. And he broke eye contact with me, which anyone who knows Mike, he doesn't really do that. And he said, we don't know what happened. He most likely panicked and drowned when keto grabbed his leg and pulled him under, period. That became the standard go-to company line from then on. However, what SeaWorld didn't know is that I was already in contact with my colleagues in Spain, and I knew that when they pulled Alexis's lifeless body from the bottom of the pool, that he had so much blood coming from his nose, his ear, his nose, his mouth, and they believed his ears, because it was just everywhere, all over his face, and then all over the stage. And then as Brian Rokish, the SeaWorld supervisor who was there at the time, was frantically trying to revive him, blood was all over Brian Rokish's face. The important point of that is that that was never, ever communicated to any of us at Shamu Stadium, ever. Clearly, this reflected that he had massive internal injuries, and the autopsy report also reflected that in graphic detail. Management never even went over the autopsy report with us. So they left it, even to the day I resigned in August of 2012, that he most likely panicked and drowned when keto pulled him under. So, anyway, so that's disgusting. So, about Don. So when Don died, they shut up quick. There was absolutely no discussion. I mean, obviously there was discussion about, you know, obviously that this had happened. But what happened, how they tried to rescue her, what worked, what didn't, all that became a no-no topic you don't bring up. And I remember one time Chuck Tompkins, who's the corporate VP of animal training, he came to Texas, and I had a very good relationship with Chuck, and I pressed him because I wanted to see the video, even though I had known Don for 9 years and I knew it would be hard to watch. From a behavioral standpoint, I wanted to know if there was a place where she was trying to work him through it and maybe see where if something was working and she was making progress, but then she lost him again. So just from a behavioral standpoint, I was fascinated by trying to see if she even had that ability to try to work him through it. And Chuck shut me down pretty hardcore and pretty quick. He just said, John, very aggressively, he said, there is nothing there. So I knew my place with Chuck, and I didn't push it any further. But I would get more of that. So here, now I'm reading from the book, which you'll be able to tell. So I'm sorry if I'm breaking personal contact, but this is important for me to read it the way that it is. I get more of the inside story after I visited the Florida facility in December 2011. Every year, each park in the SeaWorld system tries to send one trainer to one of the other facilities. It wasn't really to learn from each other, as is evident from the way Lindsay and I argued over behavior protocols in Antibes. San Diego, San Antonio, and Orlando were all very much set in their ways. But it was a chance to get to see what those differences were and a chance to network. I get into a wetsuit and be on stage and poolside watching how the trainers interacted with the whales during sessions and shows. And being in Orlando also gave me a chance to see how the park was dealing with Tilikum in the aftermath of Don's death. As a member of the big SeaWorld family, I'd met some of the Florida trainers before. In fact, I'd known some of them for years. Of course, I'd known Don, like I said, for 9 years. As the week of my visit went by, I would hear about what happened on that day as they tried to rescue Don, and these were people who were directly part of the rescue effort. They were actively pulling the net to force Tilikum into various pools, so these were firsthand rescuers. Okay, that's always how I always do it. As the week of my visit went by, I would hear about what happened on that day as they tried to rescue Don. The one story that moved me the most involved a highly experienced trainer named Lars Cervik, and it reflects what I believe about trainers and whales having a bond that not even a tragedy can break. Laura is probably the most experienced and knowledgeable orca trainer in SeaWorld, with 24 years of experience at Shamu Stadium. She had worked with Tilikum when he arrived in Florida in January 1992 and knew him better than anyone else. But as the result of a promotion to become the second highest ranking animal curator in Orlando, Laura had been reassigned to Dolphin Stadium, which is kind of a side story to that, but that's out of the book, at the end of 2009. So just a couple of months before Alexis and Dom were killed, they had moved Laura Cervic and also another very experienced trainer, Liz Morris, out of Shamu and moved them to Dolphin Stadium. And again, there's an interesting backstory to that. Laura and Don were best friends. They wore rings to signify the strength of that friendship. But February 24, 2010 would bring two of the most important beings in Laura's life in fatal conflict. It was like having a good friend kill an even better friend. Laura was at work on her side of the Marine Park at Dolphin Stadium. She was on the phone with Kelly Flaherty Clark, the animal training curator at Orlando. So this is the person that basically took Laura's job, and then Laura got shipped off to Dolphin. Hint, hint. So when Kelly said she had just been told by Dan Brown, the park's president, that the emergency alarm had just gone off at Shamu Stadium, Laura looked at her husband Mike, a supervisor at Sea Lion Stadium, and said, "I've got to go now." She drove to Shamu across the compound, and it was chaos when she got there. "Who is it?" she shouted out to the crowd that had gathered. "Tillicum and Don," came the response. "He has Don." Laura ran to the platform at the Dime with Shamu pool. Tillicum had Don in his mouth. Laura recalled that Don's hair was missing. She saw that the trainers were deploying the net to try to force Tillicum from one pool into another so that they could finally get him to a med pool with a lifting floor. Her heart was racing. She didn't know whether Don was dead or alive. The trainers were able to move Tillicum into a med pool, but it was one without a lifting floor, and so they had to move him on through the linked pools. He ultimately had to go through three pools until they got him into the pool that actually had the lifting floor where they could beach him. As she later told a detective over the Orlando Sheriff's Office in a taped conversation that has been made public, quote, "My first thought was, I was very mad that we didn't have that lift station because of this animal. We know he's killed two other people," end quote. At that point, she still didn't know if Don was dead. She was still in Tillicum's jaws, and Laura began to pray about what to do next. Laura saw a Shamu supervisor, Jenny Mayro, being comforted by her husband. She walked over to hug Jenny, who said, "She's gone, Laura. She's gone." At that point, Laura turned and thought for a moment, and another trainer then ran up to her and said, "It seems as though we're exacerbating it." And Laura agreed, "Yes, you're right. Let's just calm down. I will get to Kelly." She asked Kelly Flaherty Clark, the SeaWorld curator, if she could tell everyone to just back off. "She's already gone, and we don't want him to mangle her body. She wanted to preserve the dignity of the friend she loved." After Clark ordered the rescuers off, Tillicum appeared to relax a bit. Laura then went into the locker room. She removed her street clothes and put on a Shamu wetsuit. Quote, "I had made the decision," she later told a detective of the Orlando Sheriff's Office in the taped conversation, "I'm getting that body. I'm getting my friend." Her advantage was her years-long relationship with Tillicum. "He knows me," she told the detective. The orca was finally at a pool with a lift station, and Laura waited for the floor to lift him up, essentially beaching him. She stepped onto the platform and made eye contact with the whale, who had her friend in his mouth, shaking the body back and forth. And I want to add right there that the people that, multiple people that were part of the rescue effort said that he was shaking her with such force that parts of her body were coming off. She looked at Tillicum again, right into his eyes, and said in a strong voice, and I want you to understand the situation. This is at a point where the most horrific thing is happening and people are viewing him as a total monster. And Laura, though, still had the strength to do this. She stepped over that wall and she looked him right in the eye and said, "It's all right, baby, settle down." She knelt and cradled Don's torso while Tillicum still had her in his jaws. "It's all right, let go," she told him, "let go." Tillicum seemed to be responding. The rescuers were once again trying to get a net over Tillicum's head. They had already draped one over his body. She said, "He almost let her go. Just tuck it around his rostrum and he'll let her go." They did, and she was able to extricate her friend. She now focused all her attention on Don, looking at her face and bringing the body to a place where no one could gawk as they cut the wetsuit away and tried in vain to use the defibrillator. Spell it out. To bring her back. The rescuers realized that Don's left arm had been torn off, but managed to reopen Tillicum's mouth to retrieve it. This is where some controversy comes in, where they're like, oh, well, in the movie, he says he swallowed it, whatever. As Carol and Jeff can certainly testify to, the whales will swallow things and regurgitate them back up, and they're still whole and they're still intact. They do it with their fish all the time. So he could have very well completely have swallowed the arm and then regurgitated it back up. Or it could have been just ripped off, and then as they got her body out, it was still in the back of his throat. That part is unclear. These people who told me this were the rescuers. They were behind his body, so they couldn't see at the head. So it's a little unclear, but it doesn't matter. The arm was ripped off at the shoulder. Totally, completely severed. Okay, so The rescuers realized that Don's left arm had been torn off and managed to reopen Tillicum's mouth to retrieve it. Don's sister ring, identical to the one she shared with Laura, was on the hand of that arm that he tore off. After calling Don's husband, Scott, with the news, Laura tried to help Kelly Flaherty Clark move Tillicum from the med pool to isolate him in a back pool once the mechanical lift was lowered. Still in her wetsuit, Laura took a bucket of fish and tried to convince the orca to move into another pool. He appeared to be responding to some of her signals. Good boy, okay, you ready? As she's trying to motivate him, like she's trying to like ask for simple behaviors. He'd get a simple behavior correct, and then she's trying to build on that to get him like, yes, that's right, that's what we want. Now let's go, let's move into the other pool. So that's what's happening here. And he looked like she was going to get him out of the pool. But ultimately, he refused to leave the med pool. Laura said it was because he could see that Don was still nearby, her body covered in a black blanket only a few feet away from Tillicum on the other side of the wall. He knew she was there, she told the detective on tape. That was his possession. Don't try to take that away. And I just want to go back to page 190 and 191 for just last details on it. So during this aggression, and the reason why I want to point this out is because even during the OSHA hearings, SeaWorld's expert witness that I worked with, Jeff Andrews, I worked with him at SeaWorld of California, he testified under oath that Tillicum was, quote, never aggressive with Dawn during that incident, but was rather just trying to keep her from surfacing. That was his testimony. How outrageous when she's dismembered. So Tillicum had, during this aggression, Tillicum struck Dawn several times with his head, seizing her in his mouth as he dragged her under, swimming around beneath the surface with her in his jaws. He had her at various moments by her arm, by the neck and shoulder area, by her hair, and by her leg. By the end of all this, she had been scalped, so her scalp was completely detached from her skull with the full head of hair on the bottom of the pool. Her spinal cord was severed, her ribs were broken, her left arm had been torn off, and all her remaining limbs were dislocated. This entire event, also, Tillicum exhibited highly aggressive vocalizations, and he never once came under control when they even attempted multiple, countless times to emergency recall him. So we internally never discussed this other than what it was, which was a highly aggressive event. To this very day, SeaWorld still says Tillicum did not attack Dawn. It's disgusting. I don't even know how this company has gotten this far with when things are so glaringly obvious. So that's what I wanted to read and was required to read. So where are we now? With, you know, I want to kind of, before I go into the Q&A, where are we now since Blackfish? So one of the, this is really funny, right after Blackfish came out, we may have still been in Sundance, I think, at that point, and I was speaking to a colleague of mine, and they were speaking to Chuck Tompkins, who's the VP of Animal Training, so he controls all three parks, and they asked him, so what is the game plan now? And he goes, well, what do you mean our game plan? And they said, well, what are you going to do now that Blackfish is coming out? And he goes, well, we don't have to do anything. Like, who's really going to see it? Well, the answer is, and this is according to all the numbers that have been tallied up by all the professional people that would know, that the conservative estimate is over 150 million people worldwide. So a little cocky, a little too soon there for that comment, which is, that's just SeaWorld. You got to know them. They've always been that way. So now, of course, we have historic legislation. AB 2140, the Orca Welfare and Safety Act, which I co-sponsored with Carol Ray, Sam Berg, and then myself, Dr. Naomi Rose, and Dr. Deborah Giles. We testified in Sacramento. Myself, Carol, and Sam, we all three gave our contributing, we all collaborated together and gave our official statement. As much as SeaWorld would like people to believe that that didn't succeed or it's dead, it's very much alive. It's just an interim study because it overwhelmed the lawmakers because there was such a wealth of information and this is such a secretive world. So it's an interim study. There's no doubt in my mind it's going to pass. And what happened just recently in Washington, and Carol testified in Washington, I believe that that you know it's going to pass here first. So you guys deserve, I think, to be the forefront on this. So and then you know once it passes here, it's going to pass in California. And then I also helped Republican Senator Greg Ball up in New York for it's basically the same legislation. It's dubbed the Blackfish Bill. It's worded a little bit differently, but it's essentially it's the same type of legislation that says you can never have killer whales in captivity in our state. You cannot breed captive whales. You cannot artificially inseminate. You cannot transport across state lines, and you cannot transport genetic material. When these laws pass, it's going to cut SeaWorld off at the knees, and they know it. And that's why they're scared to death. So the writing is on the wall, and you know, there's a huge power shift that has happened, and all you guys know it, and I can feel it in this room. I mean, a huge power shift since Blackfish, and not to say that Blackfish started this fight. I mean, so many of you in this room were fighting this battle while I was still enjoying riding on whales, thinking I was the king of the world and had the best job in the world, and you know, and living in my selfish dream. Although I did love those whales, but you know, but it did not have the outlet to connect and, you know, with the right people at the right time to really make it mainstream consciousness. And Blackfish did that, and it mobilized people who already cared about this issue, who were already fighting this issue. And then we gained all these millions more people. So now the power shifted. They don't have the power anymore. We have the power. And that's another reason why they're scared to death. So they've threatened to sue me over the book. They started threatening to sue me in November, which was I knew was coming. So that was fun to get that little letter. And of course, I had the attorneys at Macmillan, and Macmillan is a powerhouse publishing company, but I knew I needed extra protection. So I sought out a very prominent legal firm that I'm incredibly grateful, Hoggins Berman, that took my case. And have offered me they've been incredible with me from the beginning to make sure that my rights are protected, that as an American and my First Amendment rights of free speech, that I have the right to speak about my life and my experiences. So I feel very confident with the people that I have behind me, making sure that I'm protected. So SeaWorld threatened to sue, and then they even threatened to file an injunction to try to stop the book. So clearly, there's stuff in this book they really don't want people to see. And there's so much more. There's so much more. There was so much more to Blackfish. There's so much more to my book. There's only so much that you can fit in here. But what I tried to do with this book which set out with just like, look, I'm just going to give people an accurate like snapshot of my 14 years, all the high points and all the low points. And that says it all. That speaks for itself. I didn't go into it with, I'm going to do this tell-all. But there were so many low points, it just naturally became a tell-all book. And I would find myself still almost programmed the SeaWorld way, like, oh, I can't say that because that's damaging. And it's like, why am I still feeling like I have to protect these people? Like, no, this is the truth. This is what happened. So, you know, anything now that SeaWorld tries to come out, oh, wait, I pulled it. I even wrote it on this card because I want to get the writing right. So when I, this was, I think, February 26th, I did this interview on Bloomberg. And first they were supposed to come on and debate with me, and they pulled out of it last second. And then they waited. It was a live interview, and they waited until the interview was over and submitted at the very end this, again, their infamous, carefully worded, prepared statements. And it said, despite these false claims by John Hargrove and other extreme animal rights activists. So I finally have become an extreme animal rights activist. I was like, wow, they finally have called me that, you know? So, but the interesting part about it is that they created me. I am their creation. I'm not some person that just studied them in the wild, which and then they can try to say, look, they're just crazy, because that's what we were taught and growing and coming up through the ranks of the system was to completely ignore any researchers in the wild because they were crazy that we were the leaders in the world. This total elitist mentality. We are the only ones that know how to work with killer whales. We are the only ones that know how to properly take care of killer whales. And I believed it. I believed it for years. Took everything out of their mouth as the gospel and defended them. And you know, and but now that because of everything that I know and I'm speaking the truth, now I'm no longer that person. I am an extreme animal rights activist. But I just also want to, you know, also be honest too. This has been a journey for me because when I first spoke out in Blackfish, I gave the interview for Blackfish just 7 days after I resigned from SeaWorld. And it was, all I could see was my experiences and what I could say and what I could contribute and what I knew. And I didn't know anything about wild whales. I didn't know anything about the awareness that Jeff and John, Carol, Sam, Dean, all these guys, Naomi Rose, Howard Garrett, all these people were already putting out there. Totally naive to it. So, and if you notice, even in our promotion, we did so many film festivals for Blackfish. In our Q&A, when sea sanctuaries would come up, I was silent. I was silent for a reason, because at that point, I still wasn't sold on sea sanctuaries. I was still being deprogrammed. I really was being deprogrammed. I wasn't saying I was against it. I was just like, I don't know if that's the right answer. What I knew was the right answer was that they had to stop their breeding program. This had to be the last generation of killer whales. But I wasn't yet ready in my mind to say that that a sea sanctuary or sea pen, whatever you want to call it, was viable. And that was because of my years of programming at SeaWorld. But by the time we testified in Sacramento before the California State Assembly, at that point, I had met enough people, the right minds, brilliant minds, and knew that it was absolutely possible and viable. So that was a growth process, one of many. And also in that California State Assembly, I remember, you know, because this has been a humbling experience for me, because, you know, I feel like, you know, it's easy for me to speak about these stories because I had that life. I had that dream as a child. I achieved it. I have the most amazing memories with those whales that I'll cherish for the rest of my life. And, you know, I had those experiences and I love those animals, so it makes it easy for me to speak about it passionately. But when I saw in Sacramento, after we had just testified and they let hundreds of people flood through and coming just to spend 10 seconds at the microphone to say whether they supported the bill or not. And these were all people who supported the bill for it to pass. And they were traveled from all over California, all over the United States, and even from other countries for 10 seconds to have a voice, because that's how much they cared about this issue. I remember sitting in that chair and go, my God, I made the right decision. I made the right decision to speak out, because look at what these people are doing, and they did not have that life. They did not have those experiences, and look what they're still able to do, willing to do. And so, you know, it's been a humbling experience for me, because I was not the most humble person coming out of SeaWorld, and I have to own that, and because that's the way we're trained. We were trained that we were the kings of the world, that we were the best in the world, and no one was better than us. So, and now I realize there's so much that I have to learn. I had to ask Carol something. I'm not going to tell you what it is because I'm embarrassed. But I had to even text Carol something today. I was like about to go on an interview, and I had text her real quick, and I was like, is that this or that? And she gave me the answer to it. So, I realized too that these people that I had been trained my whole life to think that were crazy, not only did they welcome me so immediately like a family, but they weren't crazy after all, and they actually were pretty damn smart. So I think that we at SeaWorld were actually the crazy ones. So anyway, that's it. So let's go to Q&A.
First, my name's Volka, and I've lived in Seattle for quite a while, but what I wanted to talk about is, you had mentioned that, you know, SeaWorld says that, well, they got to keep the world for research purposes, and the first thing that struck to me was Japanese fishing vessel, or whaling vessel, when they're chopping up the whales and they're holding up signs saying, you know, this is for research. I don't know if anyone's ever seen those videos, but do you ever make that kind of a connection with that the absurdity of both of those statements?
Yeah. I mean, eventually you definitely get there in your career. And it's where I very much attribute it to a cult-like mentality is that I can pinpoint for the last solid 3 years of my career, I fought management almost every single day on issues that were I felt like we're not right. Mother calf separations, forced artificial insemination, putting our even 21 feet long killer whales in 8-foot deep pools for hours on end, getting sunburned. I was a total thorn in their side for the last 3 years. But when I left that park at the end of the day, I fiercely still defended the company. It was like this sick mentality. Like I fought them and despised them while I was at work, but I still felt the need to defend them to anyone who questioned us. And I think too, because I took it personally, if someone said, oh, I don't think they're really right, it's right to have those animals in captivity, I felt like they were questioning, well, you didn't, you know, my love for the whales. I knew I loved the whales, so it was all mixed up. But all of those qualities are very, very similar and even identical to cult-like mentality. So I hope, does that answer your question? Kind of?
Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Hi, John.
Oh, hey.
Hi. My name is Michelle. First of all, thank you for being our voice, for the face of the passion that a lot of us share. We appreciate you and stand behind you.
Thank you.
I have some friends who are or were dolphin trainers, and it's really curious to me because I notice in them, they'll say, I'm vegan because I'm against animal cruelty, or they're really excited that Ringling Brothers are retiring their elephants, but in their minds, dolphins and killer whales are in this separate category. So I'm just curious, from your standpoint, what does it take to create the shift or the awareness that you now experience and that we know about?
Whoa, that's a good one, because, you know, people ask me, I've been criticized, then why did you stay so long? And, you know, I think everybody has a different journey. And, you know, like for me, first I started seeing it with the trainers falling from grace, then I started seeing like what was really normal versus abnormal, healthy versus unhealthy. And then feeling, then I transitioned into, well, I can fight that, I can change it because now I'm a high enough ranked trainer. Then realizing that you can't, but then feeling, struggling with, but I can't abandon them. So there's like all these stages that you have to go through until you get to your breaking point. So, I mean, your friends may come there, and I hope they do. And, you know, like I said, I was already so close. And then when how everything happened with Alexis being killed, 60 days later, Don being killed, SeaWorld blaming them for their deaths, and then the final straw was when they testified in the OSHA hearings that they had no knowledge we had a dangerous job. That was when, for me, it completely died inside me. I was like, because I still believed in that company at that point on some sick level that they would protect me for all the years of risk that I took for that company. But to hear them testify in federal court, lie and say that you have no knowledge we had a dangerous job when all your records, internal records with your signatures on how dangerous these whales are and how only certain trainers can swim with this whale because they're so dangerous. I mean, even the judge called him out on that. He said it's not even plausible. No reasonable person would even conclude that. But so, you know, I think it's just a process that people have to go through. Some people may reach it earlier than others, but hopefully your friends will.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. We're going back. We're doing like this thing?
I guess so. I don't know. I don't know if you're aware, but there's a huge controversy here in Seattle to get the elephants out of the zoo and into a sanctuary, and it's been going on for a long time. And in your travels and what you're doing, let me back up. For what you said here and the words you used, you know, you could almost substitute Woodland Park Zoo for SeaWorld in the tactics and what they say about the animals and the misinformation that they're spewing out, and it just goes on and on, and it's just so disturbing. But in any event, my question to you is in your travels and your discussions, do you see the empathy for orcas and killer whales changing, you know, moving on to like species like the elephants?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. In fact, you know, not that I wanted to fight for the rest of my life. I mean, who wants to do that? But I just felt this. I told myself once this got to a certain place of victory, which we're going to get there with the whales, you know, with the legislation in California and all that, I was like, I'm not going to have any choice, but I have to get involved with what's going on with the elephants because it just is so disturbing to me on a cellular level because you can just see it in those animals that they are so intelligent and so aware, like killer whales, that they understand what's happening to them and how their lives have been sacrificed for profit and entertainment. So that's why it's so historic what happened with Ringling Brothers. For Ringling Brothers to come out and make the statement, and they made the statement even, cited animal welfare issues and that the shifting, how did they word it? A shift in what our consumers wanted to see. So they acknowledged that their consumers no longer wanted to see their elephants captive like that. This is a 145-year-old, more money than God, Ringling Brothers, and if they're going to retire all their elephants to an elephant sanctuary by 2018, this is only going to help the rest of the elephants, and this is only going to put more enormous pressure on SeaWorld because now we have a circus that is more progressive on animal rights than SeaWorld is.
Hi. It's funny, last night I watched the documentary about Scientology, and a lot of what you were saying today it's reminded me of the Church of Scientology. And I'm sorry if I offended anyone there.
No, I've been hearing that for days, actually.
Wow. I was wondering if L.R. Hubbard like had some affiliation to SeaWorld or something. No, my question is...
L. Ron Hubbard is SeaWorld.
Oh, dear God. Just don't let Tom Cruise come in, I guess. Anyway, I will shut up. My question is, do you keep in touch with current trainers at SeaWorld and without... How do they live with themselves, I guess, is what I'm asking. And are they there and on the precipice of coming over, or do you have a gag order with current employees? Or
yeah, okay, so I knew when I made the decision to speak out, I was going to lose almost all of my friends, which I did.
Scientology.
She's good. Sorry. No, it's true, right? Yeah. I mean, come on, let's call it what it is. Let's don't sugarcoat it. I mean, if the parallels are there, hey, it's not our fault. You know, so I knew I was going to lose those people. Some of them I didn't really care if I lost them or not, to be honest with you. And some of them I did care because I truly loved them and I didn't want to lose them and I knew I would. And I didn't have any surprises except for one. So I lost one that hurt me pretty bad. It was my former best friend of 20 years. And she betrayed me the day after I testified before the California State Assembly. They aired a video that she ran where she lied about my injury. And she was there, so she knows exactly how I was injured, and camera operators and other trainers who said that they would testify in court how I was truly injured. And she recorded this video and lied and said that I just, no whale was involved, and I just ran and just dove into the shallow area of the pool. And it was also the first time she put our friendship in past tense. So I had to hear that we were no longer friends from a SeaWorld-produced video. And we were best friends for 20 years. We used to even live together. And that one hurt. It hurt. And that one was unexpected. But it's okay. You know what I mean? It's like if there was only one surprise in there, it's pretty good. And to be honest with you, I really don't give a shit if all of them hate me, because it's about the whales. It's about the whales. So, and, you know, I lost those people. And at the time, I thought that was a lot of people. But I've gained so many more people that are, their hearts are in the right place and they don't have this glazed look over their eye of like they drank the Kool-Aid, the Jim Jones effect. I mean, it's just, so I'm much more proud, and I know in my heart I made the right decision. And if I lost those people because I spoke the truth, did I really need those people in my life to begin with? The answer is no. What did I truly lose? But I still have some that are still in the company at all three parks, which SeaWorld, of course, just can't stand, that are secretly on my side. They can't say it publicly or they'd be fired immediately. But they keep me very well informed of what's going on the inside, and they are rooting us all on. They go out in disguise and watch Blackfish. They buy in the book. And just being like, yes, yeah, stick it to them because they deserve it. Like, it's about time they get hammered. So SeaWorld would love to think that they can control everything, but this is once again where they underestimate. They underestimated Blackfish. They underestimate their power of control over other trainers. And then I know that there are other trainers that are close to coming out. And again, I feel like I gotta, you kind of like can't pressure those people. It's their life. It's their journey. They have to take that step when they feel comfortable, because it's a scary step. But, yeah, so good question. Hey.
Hi. So I'm
how old are you?
I'm 11.
That's a good age.
And my friend and I, we're starting a club to help the orcas at our school.
Nice. Very nice.
Because you can't really arrest somebody who's protesting against SeaWorld when they're 11, right? So.
That's right.
So my question was, did you guys hear about that new campaign that kind of blew up in their face?
Of course. They ask me anything or whatever, but
yeah,
then they wouldn't
the
answer
are,
it and then they blocked them.
Why do you treat your animals so horribly?
Yeah, I like, there was a tweet that I saw from, like, it was a famous NASCAR driver, race car, I don't know, NASCAR, race car, I don't watch it, but race car driver, let's just say that. And she was like, not only would SeaWorld not answer my questions, but they blocked me. So their hashtag Ask SeaWorld, it doesn't really apply when you don't answer the questions and then you block people, so.
And is your book appropriate for kids my age?
Talk to your mom.
Okay.
I'm not going to get in trouble on that one.
And one more thing. So it's not just me starting the club. It's me and my friends, and we're doing it at our school. We're trying to raise awareness. We're trying to, you know, posters. We want some people to watch Blackfish if they get parental approval. So, yeah.
Well, thank you very much. You're doing awesome.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Let me shake your hand. Seriously, you're doing a good job. Give me a hug. That's very good, sweetie. Thank you.
Hi. So I know that you've gotten a lot of criticism since you've come on Blackfish and written the book about how you worked there for so long and then came out against it. And I was just doing some more research and found that you were arrested for domestic assault a few years ago for beating your sister. And I was just wondering how that domestic assault a few years ago for beating your sister at your mom's house. And I was just wondering how that affects your ethics. Oh, you're not John J. Hargrove?
Oh, I was arrested? No, I was never arrested for domestic...
You were charged with domestic assault?
No, I was never arrested for assaulting my sister. I don't think so. Okay, thanks. I don't think I was ever arrested. I would know if I was arrested for domestic assault against my sister. Thank you very much. Okay.
We'll take one more question.
Nice.
I'm going to be positive.
Or I'll assault you.
I know, right? My name's Shannon Newell. I'm sure you've seen me on Facebook.
Yes.
Okay. So I'd just like to ask you, like, how have you, and for all the trainers, you guys are awesome, and what you have done, for those of us who have been fighting for this for a very long time, I have nothing but admiration for you, because I can only imagine the amount of crap that you have taken from SeaWorld. I worked for a large major corporation, and it was actually Carol Ray, when I heard her speak for the first time, is what gave me the guts to get out. And that's not easy when that's your job, that's your life, that's your income, everything. And I have nothing but admiration for you, and I'd just like to say that. And say
thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I appreciate it. Very much. Very sweet. Thank you, honey. Very nice. Thank you. So do you want to... So now I would like to call up Jeff and Carol. So Jeff Venturi and Carol Ray, who starred in Blackfish. And I know you guys want to see them. Wait, where's your mic?
Don't talk.
Yeah, don't talk, because, yeah, okay, sweet. Thank you, her friend. Thank you. Yeah, I have a hot mic on. So is it this mic that you guys have to use? Or you have your own mic? Yeah, this is your mic.
Hi, everybody. I'm Carol. And I was so excited when John's little PR tour took him here. And he mentioned that he would have us come up and maybe say a few words. And he was like, just don't talk about my book. It's not about talking about my book, right? Like, of course I'm going to talk about your book. No, but that's just John. And I think that... I couldn't ask for a better spokesperson for the whales, and I just couldn't be more grateful to have him out here doing this tour, writing this book, telling his truths, and I really wish that I had had the opportunity to work with him at SeaWorld. I think we would have connected on a lot of levels, and all I can say is that I have such respect for the fact that he speaks from his heart so genuinely. And I have no doubt that you can trust absolutely everything and anything that comes out of his mouth about his experiences. So thank you, John, for being such a great friend to the whales and to all the people out there fighting the good fight for those
thank
whales.
Thank you, honey. Thank you. That's so sweet. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. My name is Jeff Venturi. I think the most... great thing that I've seen is John mentioned it earlier that he's had this transformation since leaving SeaWorld, and you know, being a killer whale trainer is something that SeaWorld instilled into people as something that was worthy of a lot of pride, and you feel like you're Superman when you're doing it. So he's had to make a very fast transition from August of 2012 to standing before you all here tonight. And it's worth noting that, you know, 50 years ago, Ted Griffin paid $8,000 for a northern resident animal named Namu and put put them here at the Seattle Public Aquarium, and it's amazing how much has changed in 50 years. John has taken the torch for this movement, the Blackfish movement, and it does take a village. I know David Neuwert's here tonight. He's got a book coming out in June called Of Orcas and Men, and Samantha Berg is in Orlando next weekend running a triathlon on behalf of Tillicum combined with a protest. John Jett and I have a peer-reviewed paper coming out in the Journal of Marine Mammal Science next week that will directly contradict SeaWorld's survival claim, so that's going to be out in April. And it just takes all of us here to be aware. We're winning the public awareness battle right now, but really until laws begin to change or laws that are already in the books begin to be enforced, really nothing's changed. So, I mean, we really need to develop an overwhelming majority of like-minded people to push forward legislation in various local, state, and federal government municipalities and so forth. So thank you, John, for carrying the torch, pushing it forward, and thank you all for being here tonight.
Thank you. Do you want to come up on stage and come up? Oh, yeah, let's put the girl in the middle.
Girl sandwich.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, guys. Now I want to call up Howard Garrett, who's here. Now, you guys know who he is. He doesn't need an introduction. Thank you, my friend. Thank you.
Well, first, thank you, John, for bringing me up and for being here and for being such an eloquent spokesperson and for being so congenial and affable and such a perfect personality for carrying the torch, for being in the media all over the place. What, Bloomberg News, The Daily Show, CNN, NPR, it's going on and on and on. And I'm just so happy it's John. He's just doing a beautiful, beautiful job. Not only is he extremely eloquent and easy to listen to, but his integrity level is just so high. Everything he says rings true, and he's credible. It's just it's great to have him here. And one thing that I think you're also doing is you're, along with the great exposés of SeaWorld and bringing it down and knocking it down at the knees, is you're raising the level of empathy because you have so much for the whales that you loved. You're really helping people to get some insight into how you related with those whales and how they related with you, how their personalities came through to you. And I really feel like it's not a very long step to apply that to the whales that live here. They're the same whales. They're the same orcas, just they've been living in the ocean all their lives instead of in a tiny concrete box. And you're really helping to promote all the programs and all the issues and campaigns and everything that we need to say to bring people into awareness about the whales that live right here, right in the Salish Sea. And in fact, I do have a little bit of news that is not totally, completely confirmed to my knowledge, although I think it probably has been now because the photos are on Facebook. We have a new J-Pod baby seen today. J-52, seen just west of San Juan Island heading north. Don't know the mom for sure yet, but that's 4 new babies in 3 months. That is fantastic. That's very good news. And I also want to say a lot of you know that Susan, my wife, and I, and a whole village of people, many of whom are here, have been waging a campaign about the whale in Miami, Lolita, who was captured right up the road here in Penn Cove in 1970. And I would like to inform you that John is way up to date on Lolita, knows that story very well. I think we'll be hearing some more about that later on this summer. But to make this happen. And, you know, if you go back 5 years, we were in the doldrums. You know, there really wasn't much going on. There was a little bit of, you know, knowledge being passed around, but there was nothing going on like there is today. And now I could recount the steps to where we are now, but we're kind of on the cusp of a really major, major breakthrough. And like JV was just saying, it takes a village, and we're getting there. And it is that change in public attitude and awareness and understanding and force of expression of all of what you know about these whales and what needs to be done that is changing those laws. And the laws are changing. The judges are starting to come around. The agencies are kind of wavering, but they can be reached, and we're getting there. So I want to thank you, John. You are propelling that wave. We've got a huge movement going on now, and no one of us can do it. No, even all of us in this room. There's a whole lot of people across the country and around the world making this happen, but you're a prime mover, John, and thank you for being part of it.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Bob. Thank you so much. Ready for our pictures?
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. If you value this episode or this series, please share your appreciation by posting a good review. It'll help other listeners find us. John Hargrove's new memoir is Beneath the Surface, Killer Whales, SeaWorld, and the Truth Beyond Blackfish. He spoke at Town Hall Seattle on March 30th, 2015. Town Hall and University Bookstore sponsored this event as part of the Seattle Science Lectures. Thanks again to Jenny Cecil Moore for this recording. Tune in next week for another amazing talk. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.